Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have back on the show Gamar Rudolph. He joins the show to discuss a new book that he has collaborated on. It's the Holocaust Encyclopedia. Gamar, how are you doing?
Indeed, indeed. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm doing pretty good.
Thank you for coming back on the show. It's been several years. I was alerted to this. I got the PDF copy. I purchased the PDF copy of it. I know you also get in hardcover and soft cover at the website, and of course
encyclopedia.com or newbook.org,
and I'll provide a link for that, of course, when I post this. You, of course, you are the founder of a small revisionist outlet. It was Castle Hill Publishers, correct?
Yes, indeed. It's defunct right now. I don't know whether we can resurrect it, but I established it back in 1998 in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been under my informal control, or as a main contributor, manager of production manager for all these years until in late 2022 when I relinquished control, and that's when things went a little bit off the track initially, and then more and more, and eventually it collapsed. That's a different story. So we have reorganized. We have now a different company. That's it's Armreg. .co.uk that has taken on that legacy. And if you read the name backward, ARMREG, it actually stands for Academic Research Media Review Education Group Limited. A little bit of a mouthful here. The initials of those words are ARMREG. You read that backward, the initials, it's GAMRA.
Okay.
It's not quite GAMRA, but it's GAMRA. We couldn't get it made. Actually, the person who established it in the UK didn't tell me what he was doing. He just came up with that name for a reason without telling me and established the company. And later he told me, well, do you know what that stands for? And I looked at it and I realized as a kid we had the game of talking backwards. So we would take a word and spell it or pronounce it by reading it backward, and this is where you would talk. The sentence would still go forward, so you wouldn't flip the sentence,
mm-hmm.
but every word was flipped, and we would do that. And I know my name is Ramrek Flodur or Flodur Ramrek, and so with that in mind, I looked at Ramrek. Wait a minute, sounds like Ramrek. You got my name backward almost. Yeah, that's what I did. Oh, so okay, anyway. This is where things have happened over the past half year. And this is also the outlet that published the Holocaust Encyclopedia. We set up that company, my friend in the UK did. I'm an employee formerly seen. I have no stakes in ownership. We set that up in the summer to initially publish only the encyclopedia. But when Castle Hill went belly up and got in trouble, got a licensing agreement with Castle earlier this year and took on the book program and have expanded it since. So this publishing revisionist books challenging the mainstream, the orthodox Holocaust narrative, or scrutinizing it, has been my main activity, professionally speaking, ever since I established Castle Hill, already 2 years before that, actually. Since the mid-1990s. And it's been my life's passion. And over the years, I've published some, right now we have 80 plus books in the English language in our roster, most of them addressing that particular topic. And the core of the work is in the so-called Holocaust Handbooks. It has its own website too, holocausthandbooks.com, which most of them are hard-hitting forensic and archival research studies on certain aspects of the so-called Holocaust, certain camps, certain crime events, and many of them are addressing Auschwitz because the documentation on Auschwitz, on the Auschwitz camp, is the biggest of all the alleged crime scenes of the Holocaust. So this series is now 52 volumes, still growing, and it is so much information going in such minute details in all these aspects that I investigated that is difficult for any outsider to wrap their heads around. It's even difficult for me at times Now, I have published these 15 two books in English, in German, many of them in many editions, which means you have to redo them and revise them and read them again. I have produced them as print books, as ebooks, and some of them as audio books. So when you do an audio book, you go through it again. I'm just now doing Arthur Butz's Hoax of the 20th Century as an audio book. So I read it again. I don't know how many times. So not only have I published these books, I've peer reviewed them. I've translated them in several languages. I have cooperated in getting them in other languages translated, and I've reissued them everywhere. So if there's anyone in the world who knows the contents of these things kind of by heart, it's me. I've gathered all this knowledge, but the series is a complete information overkill for pretty much anyone on this planet. And there's people who buy the whole series, 52 books. And then if you start reading it, we're talking 18,000, we're aiming at almost 20,000 pages of thorough research. It takes a long time to absorb all it. And when you have reached the end, you've forgotten again what you have read at the beginning, because it's probably going to take you a few years to get through this. It's taken me 30 years to produce it. And if you then think, well, I want to know a lot more about the Holocaust, therefore I'm going to get this series. But then you're faced with a problem. You want to know some aspect of the Holocaust. Where can I find hard-hitting information about when the Treblinka camp was open? Or where can I find something about medical care in Auschwitz? I mean, you find monographs that address these particular issues, but then you still have to find a particular information inside that book. Or if there is certain aspects about a person, has Hans Stark, a former SS guard in Auschwitz, made statements after the war, what he experienced, where would I find that? You have to go through the indexes of the books and maybe you get lucky. You would eventually. Even I sometimes have trouble finding and remembering this aspect, where and which of the books is it written, because several books cover one topic. We have on Treblinka, we have at least two books, for instance. And I have to look several times before I find what I'm looking for. And I'm so intimately aware and knowledgeable of their contents. How much more difficult is it for the average person out there who has not absorbed these books, produced these books over and over again? It's virtually impossible, because they are not built in any way to get quick access to information. So we have a complete information overkill in a way that's, I would say, disorganized, not well organized to find the information to make it accessible.
And of course, the encyclopedia puts it in one volume or one publication.
That's exactly the point. How do I make that information accessible? And I had my one book, that's volume 15 of the series of lectures on the Holocaust. They try to make it accessible in an entertaining way of a discussion between me as the lecturer and the audience that have resulted from actual lectures that I've given in the early 1990s. And I've kept them up to date, and they try to be encompassing while at the same time readable. But still, it has a subject index. You kind of can find a lot of stuff in the book if you're looking for certain keywords, but still it's not really the thing you would want to really find all the information, access to it quickly. So in 2021, there was, I think, some Israeli watchdog organization that I don't remember exactly. I didn't grab a hold of that PDF file that was sent to me, that was issuing one of their usual yearly reports on anti-Semitism. And Holocaust skepticism gets lumped into that. Anyone who is suspicious or skeptical about certain aspects of the mainstream Holocaust narrative gets lumped into the big category of anti-Semites, which is nonsense. Just because you don't believe everything about a certain issue doesn't mean you're hostile toward Jews. There's just no truth to it. There can be, of course, some people hostile to Jews find a liking in revisionism because they know it hurts Jews, Well, it can hurt Jews, and or dis is disliked by Jews, and they want to annoy Jews, and therefore they see that it's instrumental. That's not the right approach to the topic. But be that as it may, I'm getting a little bit off the track here. What I'm getting at is, I read in this report that under the section Holocaust denial, that my publishing company of your Castle Publishers was the only outlet left that produces new and relevant material. And that was kind of what they expressed. That is kind of a praise, a good thing to read, new and relevant. But then they said Gemma Rudolph published an Holocaust encyclopedia, or an encyclopedia of the Holocaust denial, in parenthesis, denial. I read this and said, no, I did not. This is just a lie. I did not publish a Holocaust encyclopedia. I was peeved back then because what they were probably referring to was either the Holocaust Handbook series, which in its amount of information is more than an encyclopedia, but it's not organized in any way that would deserve the name of a reference book or a reference collection. And I had my lectures on the Holocaust, which on the back cover say it is encyclopedic in scope. So they may have referred to one or the other, but they didn't name the thing by its proper name. Because that's what I've repeatedly seen in these reports when they're referring to literature they do not want to advertise or promote in any way. Then they circumscribe it or mistitle it or give it a completely different name in order not to give people a hint at what they could be searching for. If they said, well, here's this encyclopedic Holocaust handbook series, people read this and say, I'm going to Google that, enter Holocaust handbooks, and boom, the website comes up, and suddenly you have 52 hard-hitting scientific in-depth studies refuting certain aspects of the Holocaust. That's the last thing these Israeli watchdog organizations want to happen, and therefore they mislabel stuff. So I was ticked about that. But it took me a while for this annoyance to clear and come to think of it. Right, I did not write a Holocaust encyclopedia. What I should. It's exactly what's missing. We have that much information, but it's not accessible. So I, in early 2022, created the project of publishing an Holocaust encyclopedia. And the idea was to gather all the revisionist scholars on the globe that could contribute and divvy up the challenges, the hundreds of contributions that need to be written, and get it going within a few years, maybe. The thing, unfortunately, fell a little bit apart really quickly because most people I approached turned me down. They didn't want to get involved, too much work, they don't have the time, or they're just out and they have burnout syndrome. Whatever the case may be, left standing were only three scholars, and one of them later bailed out too. So we were two left standing. One of us had actually experience in contributing to encyclopedias. I've never contributed to any before. I'm only a consumer of encyclopedias. And he said, well, you normally you have to have at least 50 contributors, if not more, for a massive undertaking like this, and it takes many years to get it done. But that doesn't take into account that the person, assuming there is a person who has encyclopedic knowledge of a topic. Usually you have an encyclopedia that covers a broad range of topics. Mm-hmm. The Holocaust is a broad range of events covering 4 years, a whole continent, and thousands of locations and thousands of people. So no particular person can be expected to be knowledgeable at everything. So you need experts from all fields, and you want the best. And but if you had a person who had the encyclopedic knowledge of pretty much covering everything, well, being able to cover everything, and who has the time to dedicate to it professionally 24/7, so to say. A normal encyclopedia gets written by all these experts who have real lives, real jobs, and they have to write their contributions to an encyclopedia on the side. Encyclopedia is a prestige project, but it's not a source of income. You know, you're never going to sell hundred thousands of encyclopedias, and then it has to be divvied up among all the contributors. There's very little left at the end of the day for individual contributors. You're not going to make you rich. You're not going to drop your day job in order to write an encyclopedia. It's not going to happen. But if you had just one person with an encyclopedic knowledge, basically, who has nothing else to do but dedicated himself completely to that project, and then you can get it actually done. I've seen this because that's what I did. I was in this singular situation of having published all the relevant literature in the field when it comes to skepticism, also requiring knowledge of the mainstream literature, because a lot of our works are actually addressing, refuting, correcting the mainstream literature, the relevant mainstream literature. So I get to know both sides of them. We make the, you have thesis and antithesis, and then you have the synthesis. And I was in the position for 30 years of organizing this work, of publishing this work, of gathering this knowledge and going through it over and over again and not realizing what I was building up in my head, in my library, on my computer was this encyclopedic knowledge. And then I was in the situation that life put me in, that my family kind of fell apart and I was on my own, didn't have a household to run and children to raise anymore. Nothing better to do than to do some serious work therapy for myself, sit down and write the damn thing. It has 597 contributions, and I've written 592 of them.
Wow.
I think 98.5% or so.
Yeah, the first entry is absurd claims. I thought that was fitting.
Yeah, not by design. It just happens to be alphabetically sorted.
Yeah, I know, but I had to laugh when I saw it.
It's just the way it is.
There are plenty of absurd claims. Yes.
Yeah, absurdity is one of the first words in the alphabet, and it just happens to be how it starts out. And this is, you know, I was thinking it is kind of provocative, and I don't want this thing to be provocative more than it already is by its mere existence, but I can't help it. I can't change the alphabet just because I don't want this entry to be.
But yeah, you can open it up, look at it, peruse it, pick out a topic, look up Nuremberg, look up Auschwitz, or look up Treblinka, or look up Hermann Göring, or, you know, or Eamon Goth, the character from... Most people know him from Spielberg's, you know, Schindler's List. Oh, it's kind of like a quick rundown of what really happened there, and you realize just how what a wide variance the popular understanding of these multitude of events, which we've come to know, it's come to be called the Holocaust, and the various narratives. And it's a very useful tool. It's a put it on your put it on your coffee table or something. Leave it out. For people just to look at.
Yeah, we've given it a completely innocuous name. There are already other encyclopedias out there.
Yes.
There are actually four, and they kind of all have the same name. There's an Encyclopedia of the Holocaust, then there's the Holocaust Encyclopedia, and so they all, the topic is serious. Even in the revisionist reading, things happened, bad things happened. Jews were victims, not perpetrator during the Third Reich, as long as the Third Reich had control. Of course, that kind of flip-flopped once the war was over, then the Jews turned into perpetrators. But that's a different issue. So, yeah, this whole encyclopedia actually started out defining topics by going to the subject index of my books, Lectures on the Holocaust. That's how I got the whole project kickstarted, because indeed the lectures do have an encyclopedic coverage of many topics, but we enriched it going from there. And the enrichment process was dual. First of all, I covered many eyewitness account statements. In the lectures, I cover only a few. The mainstay in the public's mind and in the... from a factual point of view, the mainstay of the mainstream Holocaust narrative are witness accounts. There's almost no physical evidence. There's very little documentary evidence. And most of the claims are based completely on eyewitness accounts, and I wanted to include them in the encyclopedia, discuss hundreds of them, more than 300, I would discuss the most pertinent and relevant testimony on all the crime scenes and all the events are in there. I discussed, I laid out what they say in summaries. And then the most important tool of a historian is source criticism that is applied rigorously to everything that's discussed, to all the evidence that are presented, to think about, is it authentic? Is it true? Is it complete? Is it believable? And we give the tools for readers to decide themselves. Here's what they claim. Here's what the physical evidence, documentary evidence says, confirming or contradicting it. You make up your mind. I was initially intimidated. You know, people don't sit down and write encyclopedias. That just doesn't happen. Encyclopedias always in the history of mankind have been collaborative works of massive corporations of a lot of scholars. And I don't know of any single person of having sit down and written an encyclopedia. So this is kind of a unique thing, but it is good because it is consistent, the same style, the same approach, and all the articles are made to fit. They cross-reference each other. So if you read one topic, it can't cover everything. There are certain things that refer to other entries, and the reference is there, and they are all in sync, I would say. If you have 100 different scholars working on a project, it's almost impossible to keep everything in sync. There are difference of opinions, different sort of approaches, and there's never a way of completely cross-linking everything, every contribution to every other contribution, because 100 scholars can't know what everyone else is doing, so it's impossible. However, if you have just one person doing it all, then this is what you get. You get out of one cast, completely integral, synchronized, and referencing each other. And so it is an encyclopedia that you can even read as a book. I've heard that from a number of people. They get mesmerized, they get riveted, they get enthralled by it, and there's so much information in it that people were maybe assuming and guessing it maybe there, but then it's all there and it's all referenced, and you follow the links from one contribution to the next, and it's one epiphany after another, and it's exciting information that normally is hidden from view. Even a lot of people who think they know a lot of revisionism, there's so much more stuff in it that they didn't know that, and they find it exciting and they learn about it, and you just can't stop. Normal people that I encountered here in the neighborhood where I live, they have no interest in history, no interest in that topic in particular, but they find the book sitting around here, get curious, end up taking it at home and read the encyclopedia cover to cover.
Well, I think it's because the way
it's so exciting.
I think the way it's structured matters, because a big book will be intimidating, but if a book is segmented by its topics, the person will like it. I'll read a couple entries. All of a sudden, before they know it, they've read 10, 15 entries, and it goes on and on and on.
Yeah, you can interrupt whenever you want. You can pick up wherever you want. Nothing lost if you stop. It's not like you're losing your spot. There's no such thing, you know. And you can keep up. And it's there's always more information. It's like a Christmas experience. Every article you open is something exciting about it, and you can go back. It's Christmas all over and all over and over again. And even for me, I noticed when I was reaching the latter half or third of the book, needed to set all these cross references. I said, "Oh, well, I can't cover this topic here and this because that's a topic of a different entry." Now, which one is the entry exactly? What did I name it, and what exactly did I write there, so that I don't repeat myself here? And I had already forgotten half of what I've written at the beginning when by the time I reached the end. And I assume for a reader, it's even worse or better, because if it's a Christmas gift, and by the time you have reached the last Christmas gift, unwrapping it, you have forgotten already what was in the first one. You can't go back, and you are excited again because you discover your first. That is a Christmas like it's never ending. So it's a wonderful experience. Now, feeling incompetent to write an encyclopedia, and everyone does, and everyone should be, because nobody can write an encyclopedia single-handedly off the cuff. At least that was my attitude. It just doesn't happen. You can't refute the Holocaust, and you can't write an encyclopedia. These are two tenets of a society. No single person can refute the Holocaust, and no single person can single-handedly write an encyclopedia. And I do that single-handedly, write an encyclopedia that refutes the Holocaust. So double impossible thing that I've done, but I was of the firm opinion when I started on the journey, it's impossible. I can't do, nobody can do that. It's not going to happen. So what I did is I bought the biggest opposing encyclopedia that exists, the Encyclopedia of the Holocaust that was issued in 1990 by Yad Vashem, so the Israeli Holocaust Center. And I wanted to know, how do they approach it? What do they all include? And I actually sat down and read the damn thing. Not every article, but I had to at least starting skimming on the every entry to find out, is it relevant? Because I didn't even know, what does it mean you have to cover the entire Torah? What is it, the Holocaust? What is all involved? What should be covered? There are things that are superfluous, that are marginal. You know, you need to limit the project somewhere. You can't write about every camp that the National Socialists ran through the Third Reich, because not every camp was necessarily involved in the quote-unquote Holocaust. The Holocaust understood as a planned, systematic extermination. So we're talking about mass murder. If there's a camp where people may have died because of neglect, forced labor, and so forth, that's one thing, but it's not a planned, systematic extermination. So we leave out all the camps that are not part, and we focus on the camps where systematic extermination is said to have happened. And so you limit the project, but still, you can't be sure that even with that limitation, you cover it all. So I needed to know, what do they have in there? Start reading every entry, check it. Is it a necessary one or is it not? And when I did that, I had an epiphany discovering that the vast majority of contents of this huge encyclopedia by Yad Vashem has 1,900 pages, almost 900 entries, has nothing to do with the Holocaust in the strict sense of what I just defined, a predetermined, a deliberate, planned, systematic mass extermination, mainly by technological means. And iconic here, of course, the gas chambers. What I realized is that a good third of this Holocaust encyclopedia is what I call hagiolatry, is the veneration, the praising, and the celebration of Jewish and non-Jewish saints of the Holocaust, I would say them. Anyone who was a or has become after the war a notable person of the Holocaust, a martyr, a victim, a chronicler, a righteous Gentile helping Jews. So they are included there. 30% of all the entries are about these people who gained some notoriety because of their status as individuals in that story. And interestingly, some of them were important witnesses at the wars and or after the war. But you will not find in this encyclopedia what they testified. So there are, I think, only some 20 individuals included in the encyclopedia, in the Jerusalem encyclopedia, that were either perpetrators or victims of the Holocaust who survived and testified after the war. You would find a biography and a summary of what they did or suffered through the war, but you will not find the actual statements that they made after the war, some of which are considered mainstays of the narrative. So there was quite a revelation. Only 30% of all the entries address the core issue. 30% is just, as I said, hagiolatry. A lot of topics are addressing something completely different. They have entries for the Second World War. Why would you have to explain in a Holocaust encyclopedia what the Second World War was? This makes no sense. So there are a number of places, of even countries. There's, I think, an entry of Mauritius, the island in the Indian Ocean. Why would that be in the Holocaust encyclopedia? And so it goes on. There are a lot of entries in there that just don't belong there. A lot of hot air. And when it comes to the real hard-hitting issues, the evidence, how do we know what happened? There's nothing in it. Just nothing. And this is a shock if you realize that they present on every topic a pre-parceled, pre-fabricated narrative that they feed their readers, but they don't tell you what it's based on. It's what I've done in this Holocaust encyclopedia. Every entry, when we're talking about Treblinka, Belzec, Auschwitz, all these main locations, but also the minor ones, we go into first, what is the documentary evidence that we have? What is the history of the propaganda about the camp, the history about how it was presented from during the war until right after the war until today? How has that story about this camp shifted? It's very interesting to see how the narrative has changed. So what Yad Vashem is presenting is the situation as it was in 1990. But that was completely different in 1945 or even in 1942. And to trace the development of how these images have shifted, give you already an idea how much of it is propaganda, how much propaganda rumor mongering was involved in all these. And then you go into what forensic evidence we have. And that shows up what the real basis is of the hard facts of what we know about these camps from the physical record of traces of the crime, traces of the weapon, traces of the murder victims and so forth. And other things, water weapons, we're talking about engine exhaust gas, we're talking about the infamous Zyklon B. What is it? How does it react? What traces can be found, if any? And all the mechanics of everything, cremations, outdoor cremations. And of course, witnesses, over 300 of them. And then with all the physical delimiting factors explained in the various entries of, you know, what's the technology of burning bodies? How much does it take if you want to burn a body on a pyre outdoors? How much wood do you need? And what does a good pyre look like? There's all sorts of evidence. So there's a technological experience of mass cremations of cattle that have died in various epidemics. And there's good documentation about it, and you can make calculations how would that look like with human beings. And unfortunately, we have some experience with that too, during the firebombing of Germany. There were a lot of corpses in German cities that had to be incinerated on pyres. So there's unfortunately some documentation about that too. So we know what would have been needed and how it would have looked like. And then you can compare that to witness statements, and you come to a conclusion that these witnesses make up wild stories on many levels. And throughout the encyclopedia, with hundreds and hundreds of witnesses, you see the pattern. You see the pattern of these witnesses in many regards converging onto the same claims. They're making claims of bodies burning by themselves, not needing any fuels. They're converging to crematoria being able to burn bodies in a few minutes, when actual technology tells you it takes an hour or more. There's a convergence of hundreds of witnesses into things that are not true, but they agree. And when you look into the history of the narrative for the various camps, you see a pattern too. And I must say, I have myself not really seen the pattern, because I was caught up in these 52 volumes of detailed studies. I was in the middle of a forest. I saw a lot of trees in the middle of it. And I was proud of all the trees I was taking care of and making grow, and seedlings, planting and seeing them rise to big trees. And I was seeing the forest no more. I had to get out of it to look at it, to see the picture of the forest. And that's what I saw in myself when I was writing this encyclopedia. I saw dots connecting that I hadn't seen, because I was now collecting it and systematically putting it in a cohesive picture. And then I realized these, from every angle of those eyewitness accounts, converging in so many directions, so many topics in lies. That makes you clear where this is coming from, wartime propaganda, that You see a similar phenomenon in the witch trials, the medieval witch trials, when an entire society, an entire continent, the European continent, was caught up for centuries in these stories of what was going on on the witches' Sabbath, with the fornication with the devil and so forth. These stories have been bandied about medieval societies for so long that everyone knew the story, and witnesses going to the witness stands when the next witch was put on trial always had the same stories because everybody knew the stories and they were just repeating, presenting as their own experience, something they have heard throughout society. And back then, media and the conveyance of information, of rumors, of stories, of lore was on a primitive scale compared with the massive amount of information and disinformation onslaught we have on our brains with today's media, media, multi-sensory media, I should say, primarily visual, which they didn't have in the medieval, where hundreds and thousands of witnesses, like hundreds and millions, if not say whole humanity, has been exposed to this biggest propaganda campaign that mankind has ever seen in a completely one-sided fashion, and everyone has a certain expectation of what to expect from a Holocaust survivor, what to expect from a witness. And they know the same thing. If a Holocaust survivor over the last set decades has appeared in front of audiences, they knew the audience expects certain stories. And so they were telling, they were catering to those expectations about flames ejecting from chimneys and about bodies burning all by themselves and about gas coming out of shower heads in the gas chamber. All these things can be shown to be untrue, to be physically impossible, but they are a pattern throughout many eyewitness accounts, which is an indicator of an entire society being imbued with cliches, with stereotypes, and with massive expectations enforced in many countries by the law to have to believe, to have to tell the story as it has been told and told all over again. Any skepticism, any rational thought is being suppressed, persecuted, and stamped out in some countries violently. Fortunately, in the United States, not yet. You know, it's not for not trying. I mean, their powers want to restrict it. And even the government here in this country has made sure that no one harboring certain views that are considered anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-Jewish, can have any government employee or any contract with the government. So that's where it starts. And it's a slippery slope. We have to see where it goes. Censorship, the massive influential powers of indoctrination, the motivating factors of the various group involved, the Allied powers, even post-war Germany has a massive interest in propping up this distorted image of what happened during the war. It's also discussed in the encyclopedia. One of the biggest contributions is about propaganda, showing the contributions of every country during the war when it comes to Holocaust propaganda. Motivation is another one. And what I've come to understand, and it became really clear doing this encyclopedia, what we consider the core of the Holocaust is the gas chamber, the iconic gas chamber as the symbol of high-tech industrialized conveyor belt mass extermination with a planned program that built, designed, and built these facilities. The facilities where it's supposed to have happened, they're all located in what is today Poland. The narrative was developed throughout the war, and one of the major powers pushing it were Polish underground resistance groups that were sending news about this to their Polish government in exile. And it really took off after the war when the Soviets moved in. The Soviets then had their initial investigative commissions claiming 4 million victims in Auschwitz, 3 million in Treblinka, 1 million in Belzec, 1.5 million in Majdanek. You sum those up, and you're already in the order of magnitude of almost 10 million just for these few camps. You can already see it doesn't jibe with the 6 million numbers. It's way beyond that. So it was obvious that so it were exaggerating it, but they were doing it only for a few weeks after they'd moved in. Then they handed things over to the Poles and they were doing it from there. And they were then systematically rigging the record, pressing it into a pattern that would make it somewhat believable, and by doing so, discarding quote unquote evidence that they had actually gathered early witness accounts, which were contradictory and most certainly in many cases were completely opposite or completely in disagreement with the narrative as we know it today. The most glaring example is the Sobibor camp, where you can see how it was made. The witnesses telling one story, completely absurd, of facilities where the doors, the floors opened downward. They were hydraulically lifted downwards or lowered downwards so that the corpse would fall into some basement area, into carts that were carried away. That would be a very efficient way of clearing out a gas chamber, of course, but the engineering feat of designing chambers whose floors would lower to a discharge in the area down below, it's a massive construction and hydraulic challenge to do that. There's,
yes,
of course, no trace of it, and no sane person would have built something like that. It's much easier to kill people than building something. So it was completely invented, but for some reason, almost all witnesses right after the war agreed on this. And it's clear you have a massive convergence of eyewitness accounts on a lie. And the judge, the investigative judge who was facing that, had a problem. Because with the two other camps, that, you know, there needs to be consistency. If Germans were planning something, they were planning the same thing for all the major camps and making it systematic. But all camps were going in different directions according to early eyewitness accounts because they were obviously not synchronized, not orchestrated. They were claiming steam murder for Treblinka, diesel gas murder for Belzec, and collapsing floors with some undefined gas in Sobibor. So what the investigative judge doing these things, the Polish judge did, is he completely discarded every single witness account about Sobibor, just destroyed them, throw them out, ignore them, and replaced it with a narrative he'd just developed for the Belzec camp, for which he had also thrown out all the witness accounts and replaced them with something else he had taken from Treblinka, where one witness had plagiarized the text that resistance movement had published early on in 1942 and changed it from steam, lobster steaming chambers to exhaust gas chambers, when earlier he had made some completely different claim, but he figured the resistance report is much more detailed and credible and it's older, so I better copy that, adjust it, take the steam out because it makes no sense, and put gas, exhaust gas in there. This story was then used for Treblinka. All the steam chambers and vacuum chambers and whatever else has been claimed, thrown out, and they stuck with that one witness account, even though he had contradicted himself in the course of his own statements, but never mind. And he had plagiarized it, but never mind. Then this copy was copied over to Belzec, and from Belzec it was copied over to Sobibor. And the witness statements in Belzec, there were only three witnesses for Belzec, they were all contradicting each other and contradicting that narrative. They were force harmonized to fit that narrative, and that was copied over to Sobibor. And Sobibor, they threw out every single witness. Everything went out the door, was completely replaced. So you see the Polish judiciary completely inventing the narrative and forcing it onto all these camps against actual witness testimony. And you wonder why, and I have my own family history linked to that because my father was expelled from East Germany. If you look at the map of Poland today and you compare it with a map of pre-First World War, you see that half of the Polish territory today used to be German territory. They have, after the First and Second World War, taken over East Germany, what used to be East Germany, and it's Poland now. So the Poles had a vested interest in imbuing into the German a guilt complex, which would make the Germans accept any kind of punishment, including ethnic cleansing of East Germany of their 7 million German inhabitants and giving up any territorial claim to these East German lands that have been German ethnically, culturally speaking, for better part of 700, 800 years. And that is exactly what happened. The Germans have a massive guilt complex now. They accept any kind of punishment that was meted out during and after the Second World War against them, apart from the fact that nowadays nobody's thinking about territorial claims anymore. I'm talking about the historical reason why the Poles did what they did in order to secure the spoils of that robbery, of that land robbery, and to make sure the Germans are not going to again get into a conflict with Poland by destroying German national self-confidence. And all the Allies were on the same page. They wanted to split up and divide Germany in little bits and pieces, making it ungovernable by having millions of refugees causing all kinds of economic and social trouble, and cut down and reduce Germany in size so much that it just is weaker and weaker and weaker. So everybody was on the same page, and the Holocaust is the perfect instrument to instill a feeling of guilt in the Germans that makes them accept everything. That's how it worked, and that it was a perfect plan. It worked out perfectly. Now we're stuck with it today. This is not to say that I advocate any German territorial claims against Poland. I think that's ridiculous. Germany and Poland both go through a demographic collapse, and they're not even able to inhabit the lands they have right now. And seeing the fratricidal war that's going on in Ukraine right now, the last thing Europe needs is more strife. We need cooperation. We need friendship. Looking at the beautiful blonde, blue-eyed Polish women, the thing that separates Germans from Poles is more the language than anything else. Ethnically speaking, they have been intermingled for so many centuries that there is not much of a difference between them. To have any hostile feelings is completely out of place in today's Europe. That's the last thing we need. So I'm absolutely opposed to resurrecting any animosity among neighbors in Europe over territorial claims. In nowadays Europe, there are no frontiers anymore. Borders have disappeared. Everyone can settle where they damn well please. This nightmare of European fratricidal wars must be over. Unfortunately, it's not. I hope this nightmare in Ukraine will end soon, because the slaughtering of Europeans by themselves is a big catastrophe. And it would be the last lesson I wanted to teach. It's actually the opposite of the lesson that I want to teach with the encyclopedia. Propaganda instills hatred. Propaganda lies perpetuate hatred, and they perpetuate tensions, and they are the cause of wars. If you can see the connection now between what's going on in Gaza, and the way Israel and their Jewish supporters and Zionist supporters throughout the world justify it in order to prevent that Israel and the Jews in Israel suffer another Holocaust by an Arab onslaught, what they perceive to be as such. They claim that they're allowed to do anything to Arab populations that they consider a threat, even if that itself creates a new Holocaust, an Arab Holocaust. So you see, the Jews have been victim of that propaganda as well. They have become paranoid about their non-Jewish environment, particularly in the Middle East, thinking constantly they're under threat of being exterminated, because they're dead convinced that the Goy during the Second World War has been out to wipe them off the planet in the most atrocious and systematic way. And this story, firmly implanted in their mind, perpetuates their distrust and militant and aggressive war-mongering attitude toward their environment. And this is a catastrophe too. And I think Jews are also the ones who need to be liberated from this nightmare called the Holocaust. It needs to come to an end. And I hope that the Holocaust Encyclopedia helps on that way, along that way, because it teaches people to be critical, to know that governments, there's no news, governments lie during peacetime and even more so during war. And the biggest butcher wins the war, and whoever wins the war, their propaganda and lies maintain a presence with us, unfortunately. We need corrective forces against all propaganda lies. And this is an attempt to teach that lesson. We need to be critical and skeptical of what governments try to force down our throat. The more violent they want to force it down our throat, the more skeptical we need to be. And this is the one topic in the world today where most government force, the most intense government force is used to force us to believe and to dissuade or prohibit us even to be critical by more than 20 countries now. If you look at the censorship map in Europe, which countries have enacted Holocaust denial laws, prohibiting Holocaust denial, almost all of Europe is red. The Nordic countries don't have formal laws like Sweden, Norway, and Finland. Ireland does not yet have one. The parliament is trying to. Spain has set it free. And there are a few countries, politically not very influential, in the Balkans, which don't have laws like that quite yet. But all the rest of Europe that really matters has it covered, including Ukraine and Russia. So they both accuse each other of being Nazis one way or another, but they both have outlawed, quote-unquote, Holocaust denial, Holocaust skepticism. It's quite ironic. Israel and Canada have, Israel was the first to join the club. Canada is the last one for now. I'm sure that other countries will still follow as the European Union tries to force all members of the European Union to enact such laws. And so where people go to prison for many years for peaceful historical dissent, something is badly wrong. Western countries criticizing China for putting dissidents for many years in prison for peaceful dissent, or for Iran doing the same thing, or Russia for that matter. They should, as the Bible says, you know, don't look at the splinter in your neighbor's eyes when you have a whole beam in your own. No, I don't think that Western countries are quite as bad when it comes to human rights violations as you find it in Red China. But still, you know, before you start criticizing others, you should clean up your own mess. And granting free speech, if it's done in a peaceful, respectful way, shouldn't be a matter of discussion. That should be a matter of course. And it's not, unfortunately. Germany justifies it by saying something to the effect, in order to prevent that, as was during the Nazi time, we repeat as was during the Nazi time, to persecute minorities, to burn books, to jail dissidents, because that's what the Nazis did. We don't want that ever to happen again. In order to prevent that, we need to persecute minorities, yeah, burn books, and jail dissidents, because that's what they're doing.
In fact, I think, yeah, the post-war government has destroyed many more books than the Third Reich ever did.
Yeah, it's a matter of you know, Third Reich didn't have quite as long a time as the Federal Republic of Germany has had. So the biggest censors were the Allies after the war, who prohibited, I think, in order of magnitude of more than 50,000 books from German libraries, banned them. They have done much more of censorship in Germany in the first several years after the war than the Third Reich was ever able to do. And the biggest book burning, of course, was the incineration of thousands of libraries in Germany by the Allied firebombings. So much treasures went up in flames. So if we're talking about who did the biggest book burning and biggest book banning, that was the Allied powers in the history of mankind. Of course, that were collaterals of the war and trying to dominate after the war. But Germany has followed in that footstep, quote unquote, free and democratic Germany. They have firmly implanted censorship laws and censorship institutions. And censorship is in the head of the people. People justify censorship. Free speech can't be unlimited. There must be limits. And there are in every country, even in this country, with what they call free speech absolutism. There is no such thing as absolutism. You know, certain things you can't say. And for me personally, Free speech ends where it advocates for the violation of other people's civil rights. You cannot, morally speaking, expect your own civil rights to be respected if you turn around and using these civil rights to deny those same rights to others. So the organization that I've been involved in this is the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, CODO, had this policy for ever since it was created. We accept everything in our forum, in our discussion boards, as long as it doesn't justify, advocate, promote, or condone the violation of anyone else's civil rights. So you can argue whether the National Socialists' incarceration of Jews as enemies of the Reich was comparable to the incarceration of Japanese US citizens and German and Italian immigrants by the United States during the Second World War. But you cannot justify that this happened because it was a violation of civil rights. People should be incarcerated if individually guilty of something, not because they're associated or members of a certain group. And this is just the limit that we have to draw and we have to respect.
But as you say, it was a violation that certainly wasn't unique to the National Socialist government.
The violation of the trampling under of civil rights, if we're talking about the Allies' justification to go to war against Germany because Germany was trampling civil rights underfoot, which actually was a democratic way of doing things, you're praising democracy. Hitler was elected democratically. The Hitler government got rid of civil rights in Germany democratically. As the saying goes, democracy is when two wolves and the lamb decide what's for dinner. And so democracy in itself is a meaningless term, morally speaking. It's devoid of any meaning. Democracy is the rule of the mob. If you don't put it in a corset, in a strict, under the strict role of rule of the law that respects primarily the civil rights and the right to self-determination. The latter one I like to put in there because the conflict we have right now in Europe is a violation of self-determination, first of Ukraine, of violating this right to self-determination of the Russian minority in Eastern Ukraine, and now of the Russians trying to violate the right of the Ukrainians in general to self-determination. So the whole thing is about self-determination. I don't think that any state itself has a right to exist. A state is a idealistic construct of people coming together and saying we want to be together in one organized political body. But that doesn't give that ideological construct, which we call state, country, or whatever, a physical existence with physical rights. No, this construct depends on us agreeing to it, consenting to it, and wanting to be a part of it and wanting to have to build an identity with it and feel good in it. But it itself has no right. It's not a being with civil rights. So if
well,
a country says, I have a right of a certain territorial integrity, it's like, no, you don't. If the people living on that territory agree with you, yes. But it's the people who decide. If a certain people on a border area decide we don't want to be part of it anymore, we want to be part of our neighbor country, then if the majority goes that way, that's what they decide. You don't have a right to a territory because you, state, country, are not a person with rights. It's the population that defines the right, and if the population disagrees on something, self-determination. And you see that again and again. Scotland, Quebec, and other countries, Timor-Leste, they had the referenda. If they eventually decide the majority want to leave, we let them leave peacefully. We don't go to war over it. What kind of idiocy is that? If Scotland becomes independent and bails out of the UK and London cuts payments to Scotland and Scotland suddenly realize we're dirt poor and can't survive, they may regret it and come back home, so to say. Or on the other hand, maybe not. Maybe they fare better, or they want to risk being poorer but happier being Scottish. Whatever the case may be, people should have the right to find out for themselves, and it should all be peaceful.
Well, in many respects, the state conspires against the people, like inundating the country with illegal immigrants to change change the people, get rid of the people, replace the people. Or in the case of Germany, Germany doesn't even have a government that represents the people anymore. Recently, the Alternative for Germany party, the AfD, the government announced they may ban the party because it's getting too popular, which is.
Yeah, well, that's what democracies seem to do. You know, if democracy it doesn't have the results those in power want it to be, they just get rid of it. They had done that in Belgium when the Vlaamse Blok in the 1990s, I think, suddenly was the strongest party. They outlawed it, and that was the end of it. And then they regrouped as the Vlaamse Belang, I think, but they had crashed by then. But they're still a strong power, and you see that throughout Germany, throughout Europe, over and over again when there's a populist or right-wing movement that has concerns about identity, European identity, that the leading parties that are still in power want to remain in power and outlaw it. In Britain and in France, they've changed the way voting is done again and again in France to keep the Le Pen, what's the party, Le Front National, out of the government, because initially they switched over. You have to have a majority in what do they call it, arrondissements in France before you can have any seat. So if the National Front National doesn't get majority in any of them, they can have 40% of all the votes in the country, but not a single seat in parliament. Then they started getting more than 50%, and suddenly the ruling parties, the traditional parties, were at the shit end of the stick and getting no seats anymore. So they switched this voting system again. It's re-rigging things over and over. You see that everywhere. It's awful. It's just absolutely awful.
Yeah, and of course, getting back to the topic at hand here, the Holocaust Encyclopedia is much of the way that feelings of populism or nationalism or patriotism have been pathologized, have been sort of demonized because of the Holocaust narrative and
Well,
the
it
sort of.
depends. It's only for the European flavors of things. You know, if you look at patriotism in India or in Bolivia, populism and so forth, there is no problem with that. If you have a Amazon tribe of indigenous people wanting to be left alone, not invaded by other cultures, not be invaded by intruders, by immigrants from Europe, then that's perfectly fine, because these people are. So I don't know, why is it fine? You know, you give the people in Tibet, there's the leftist Green Party who has always been advocating for the Tibetans to have the right to be independent and to not be dominated by Chinese culture and to become independent because they were occupied by China. I don't know when that happened. I'm not too familiar with Chinese history. Anyway, Tibet is not exactly happy about it. But if it comes to their own people, the Green Party doesn't give the German people the right to be independent, to maintain their own cultural identity, and to not be invaded by hordes of immigrants and by other cultural forces taken over. That then is called Nazism and right-wing extremism. Why? Why is it perfectly legitimate if it happens in the Tibetan Himalaya or in the Amazon jungle, but it's a crime if it happens in a European country? It makes no sense.
Well,
So
I think
it's odd.
because they, I think the powers that be recognize that those ethnic groups, like the Germans or the French, the English, basically ethnic Europeans, Americans, that's an ethnic group that has agency and has the ability to actually challenge their dominance. So these groups like India or Amazon, yeah, they can say, hey, yeah, you're independent, you're free, but you have no agency, you're no threat to our interests. You know, it's the same way the left or the Jewish lobby will promote a black nationalism, a black pride, or any other subgroup like homosexual rights and things like that. These are proxy groups that are used to smash the majority, to dispossess the majority. And as of now, the majority in Europe is still ethnic French or ethnic Germans, United States as ethnic, Americans of European stock, and the objective is to dispossess them. The way you dispossess them is you demoralize them and make them actually hate themselves. Just, and that's what the pests, that's
The
what the
whole
Nuremberg regime has been all about. First, it was targeted the Germans, and it's been extended to all of the Western world now.
it was a propaganda tool used to delegitimize Germans in general, to delegitimize their existence, their cultural identity, their pride, their history, everything about it. To weaken the heart of Europe. Now, if you weaken or destroy the heart of anybody, that means that the body dies. And that's what we see now. It is wartime propaganda that was invented, cultivated, and foisted upon Germany by all its neighbors, including America. So Russia, Poland, Czechoslovakia, France, England, they all have contributed to it, and America, of course. And it's now backfiring on them because it's something that everyone's being held responsible for, quote unquote. The Western, who all was occupied by Germany and collaborated, the French collaborated to some degree, and even those who were not occupied, they didn't do enough. There's so much in the encyclopedia goes into that a little bit. The Americans and the British and all the major power knew exactly what was going on. They had cracked the German codes. They were having intelligence information from the underground, from the Vatican. So they were well informed of what was going on in the German camps. They knew what is lying, what is exaggerated. And that's why they did not react the way you would expect them to react had they known that an extermination was going on. The reaction would have been vastly different than what we actually see. And now, of course, that's turned against them because the narrative is that the extermination happened, as is claimed, that the Western allies did not do enough to fight it while it was happening, and therefore they're being held responsible too. And as a collective kind of responsibility, collective guilt, if you wish. An extension, and it backfires on everything that is European culture nowadays. So even Christian, it was committed by Christians. So everything that has Christian identity is being held responsible.
Yeah, Christian anti-Judaism is being blamed for modern anti-Semitism in Europe, particularly in Germany. And so what you're saying is that there's something, the heart of Christianity is at fault here, which means that's an indictment of Christianity, which pretty much is an indictment of the of Western culture for the past, 1500 years at least.
That's right.
And if anything, look at what, there's been a sort of a cultural supersession where the Holocaust or the religion of the Holocaust, Holocaustianity, has superseded Christianity in the West, whereas now we have blaspheme laws that in 20 countries in the so-called free West, where you go to jail, you're threatened with going to jail or fines if you publicly doubt and publicly express any doubt or skepticism, criticizing the various Holocaust narratives as supported by the regime. But no one I mean, good. Yeah, if in Canada, if you question the Holocaust publicly, you can theoretically go to jail. But if you're in Canada, if you threaten, I mean, if you question the doctrine of the Holy Trinity or the divinity of Jesus Christ, nothing happens to you. So, which is more
Let's
powerful?
say I would say if you don't question it, you may get some bad looks and be ridiculed.
That's true. Well, that's the trick. Yeah, because nature abhors a vacuum. So basically, that has superseded what was once the dominant sort of default culture of the West, which was Christianity. In the American United States, it was Protestantism with a large dose of Catholicism because of immigration in the Southwest. But we've witnessed the supersessionism in the West in the post-war period, largely because of the Holocaust narrative, which, if you study the historiography of it, it didn't really sink in until the 1970s. It was kind of suggested, and we had sort of vague references to Nazi tyranny and the Gestapo and these sort of things. But you mentioned it's sort of these very disparate stories that we just thought of as sort of unique German or Prussian militarism and brutality. That's why we won the war. That's why we fought the war. But there's never really anything specific. But then in the 1970s, that's when the term Holocaust became popular. Up until then, it was the Shoah. Then you had the 1978 miniseries. And most Americans get their idea of history and reality through television and movies. And in the I think in your in the encyclopedia, you have a chart of movies. We're going,
Right.
and it shoots up in the 1970s, and
Well, actually, in the 1990s, when we had these massive extortion scams by Jewish organization against Switzerland
that's right,
initially,
the
when they were
gold, yep.
successful there, yes, then they spread out to Hungary, Germany, France. Everyone was getting it, and at the same time, the production of movies skyrocketed. That was going parallel with that. It was the propaganda artillery. Shooting everyone, softening up everyone by just barreling.
Yes, I mean, how can you question the Holocaust? I saw Schindler's List,
That's right. We
right?
hear that over and over again. I saw this in that documentary. It's not even a documentary, but even if it is a documentary, the footage that you see in quote unquote documentary is staged, is made up. Because there is no footage, original footage of anything with the Holocaust. So you have to, there's very little, let's say it that way, from the Eastern Front. Eastern Front, a lot of atrocities happened on both sides of the equation. And there's some footage that is pretty atrocious. But when it comes to gas chambers and mass murders and piles of bodies, there's just nothing because
Yeah,
nothing was
it was
recorded.
Hors d'Oeuvre. I think the first camp was Hors d'Oeuvre, and that's when they started faking it. Then there was the Dachau camps with the typhus victims and the bombing victims, and that's when Eisenhower brought in his Billy Wilder and Alfred Hitchcock to do their stuff. And but in the
Right.
East, even he talk about now that just talk of this Holocaust by bullets, not gas chambers. And now you're changing the story again, okay? Changing the story, which is it? Shifting narratives is an indication that you're lying, by the way. They try to say that, well, the Eastern Front and the Einsatzgruppen, the special police battalions, and the various counterpartisan activities, which is brutal, but that's the nature of counterpartisan warfare, because the partisan, that's just what happens when you fight partisan warfare. Or you have in the in like in Russia, where you had these partisan groups that weren't abiding by the rules of law, so it got very brutal in the East. And those areas that had most partisan activity had the most brutal warfare. Those areas that had very low partisan activity had very little atrocities, like in Czechoslovakia or like in France. It was much more brutal in the East because you had much more part, you had much more intense partisan activity in the Balkans and in Russia. And within that's a lot of pretend. That's not the Holocaust. That's not, as you said, not the planned industrial killing to wipe out European Jewry. It was a consequence of the war in the East and the fact that
Yes and no. If you read the contribution on the Einsatzgruppen in the Holocaust Encyclopedia, it's not quite that easy. They were massacres reported, documented, and against Jews where things were not necessarily already early in the war, where there was kind of a general reckoning. I would say a retaliation of what Germany and their collaborating forces, mainly Ukraine and the Baltics, saw as Jewish atrocities in connection with the Bolshevist Revolution and
Yeah,
the
but so
terror reign
wasn't
that was came afterwards.
wasn't not the Germans? There's actual people there doing it. The Germans didn't stop them or something. Or
Well,
I mean,
there
I
were
heard,
all kinds of things, pogroms that
but
broke out without Germans doing anything about it, and were pogroms
yeah.
that the Germans instigated. Then there were pogroms that the Germans stopped. Then there were shootings that the Germans themselves did without pogroms. All these things were happening.
It's extremely messy what you're saying.
Yes, and
So
then
that's
there
not
were.
the Holocaust. I mean, that's not the final
It
solution
depends
plan.
on the edge, the eastern edge of the Holocaust, if you wish, is fuzzy, where outright mass execution of Jews just because of Jews. You have the transition to where Jews are mainly involved in partisan warfare and they get killed because they are partisans. And you have pogroms that are, strictly speaking, not part of the Holocaust as such, but that's all a matter of definition of where you draw the border between what is what. And so it's fuzzy when it comes to these things. And to be honest with you, I don't claim to have definite answers of what exactly happened and to what degree. There is just not enough data. There was not done any reliable research at the end of the war because nobody had an interest in really. They were happy with doing propaganda, particularly the Soviets. The last thing they wanted to have is an independent international commission of neutral forensic experts digging up the soil in Russia and Ukraine, because numerically speaking, what they would have found mainly would have been victims of Leninist, Stalinist, Bolshevist terror, which has cost, by the end of the Second World War, the better part of 20, maybe 30 million of victims. There may have been 1 million or 2 million Jews in the ground that the Germans killed, but there would have been only 10% or so of all the corpses in Russian and Ukrainian soil. So no matter where you dig in this area, you will find 90% likelihood communist victims of terror rather than terror victims of the German brief occupation.
So the most
And
famous
I'm
example
sure.
out is the Katyn Forest Massacre, of course.
Right. And a lot of things that were reported after the war by
If I'm not
so-called
mistaken,
Soviet
wasn't it at
commissions.
Nuremberg? Wasn't Katyn officially a German crime at Nuremberg? Classified?
The Soviets made that claim during the trial, but it was not included in the verdict because the British and the Americans knew better and
No.
they didn't let that include.
Yeah.
The Russians had their own choke trial in Leningrad, where they hanged a number of German prisoners of war. Oh, at that time, they weren't prisoners of war anymore. Or was it still doing the? I don't know. Anyway, they got sentenced to death and got killed because they were held responsible for the Katyn murders, which obviously we know is it was a Soviet crime.
But the ferocity of the war in the East, one thing, because the animosity between the Germans and the Russians, of course. But the
No, don't, it was the animosity between National Socialism and Bolshevism
that's
communism.
what I meant. Yeah,
I
the
wouldn't put the
ideological.
peoples against each other. I don't like that because, as I said, we're all Europeans. We shouldn't do that.
But
It was
Germany saw itself
ideological
as
confrontation.
Germany saw itself as confronting Judeo-Bolshevism. That was their
Right.
rationalization
Right.
for the
But
attack.
it wasn't even justified anymore. If you look at the anti-Jewish cleansing that Stalin did in the mid 1930s, where the percentage of Jews in the Soviet administration drastically dropped from some 40% down to only 1 or 2%. You could see that. And then between 1934 and 1938, I think Stalin cleansed the apparatus of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Jews. So he had his own anti-Jewish annihilation going on during that time. So by the time the war broke out, the Jewish dominance had come to an end. Now it regained dominance again because of the war. So it was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecies with the Germans, with the National Socialists, with their declared intention to go after the Jews, or the propaganda in claim that they would annihilate the Jews. Jews naturally identified with Bolshevism, with the Stalinist regime, and became again a major power in the Stalinist apparatus of suppression and warfare. And that ended again after the war, when Stalin dismantled that power structure again. So
Yeah, the
he had his
doctor's
own
plot
ways.
and his
Yeah, that
concerns
was,
over
of
Jewish
course, he
support for
died over
Israel.
that. So
Yeah.
I guess that didn't go down well. But he did not manage to implement that. He died before that. Some
But
speculation
the,
on
I
how
mean,
he died.
to tag the Germans as some sort of a unique crime when all combatants were guilty of mass, casualties and targeting civilians, particularly the Allies. I mean, you mentioned, you alluded to, but the firebombing of German cities, and the of course, right after the war, you alluded to it earlier with about your father, the forced removal of ethnic Germans from Eastern Central Europe, where I think some 12 million, estimated as many as 2 million people perished in that
Yeah.
forced removal. Yeah.
The only part of German civilian casualties of the war, of the ethnic cleansing, the mass murder against Jews that were officially investigated and numerically assessed was the ethnic cleansing in Eastern Europe, because we had the Cold War and West Germany, supported by the Eastern Allies, was encouraged to paint the Western country, the Eastern countries who had done this ethnic cleansing, Poland, Russia mainly, but also Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, and to minor degrees, Hungary, to paint them in a bad picture. And so the ethnic cleansing acknowledged by the government, documented 2.1 million people died and 12 million all over Europe were ethnically cleansed. I think that's the figure. The same was not done with things that happened in West Germany with the automatic arrest, with the disarmed enemy forces, with forced deportations, and with the hunger blockade that led to a famine in Germany for until 1948, 49, where uncounted millions died. It's not properly recorded because there was no authority in power that had an interest in recording it, because basically it was the occupational powers that were causing the famine, and they did not want it documented, and therefore there is no documentation about it. And the German government later on was discouraging any attempt to do it, and was actually going to great lengths to suppress any attempt to do that, because it would shed bad light on their current friends and allies, and they didn't want that to happen. So we don't know exactly how many civilian German casualties due to illegal warfare, war atrocities by the Allied parties were did occur, and we don't know exactly what the total is. At the end of the day, it could be something like symbolic, like 6 million, for all I know, plus or minus, could be more, could be less. The best attempt that we have had of someone trying to come up with a number was the Canadian author James Back with his two books, Other Losses, where he talks about the disarmed enemy forces after the war, who had been stripped of the POW status and were outside of any law, so to say, under Eisenhower. Hundreds of thousands of German former soldiers camping in prisoner camps without any care and died like flies by the tens or hundreds of thousands. And then in his second book, Crimes and Mercy, he was talking about general civilian casualties due to the hunger blockade and the famine in Germany. And he was enumerating it to a total of something like 6 million, counting the firebombing campaign, the ethnic cleansing in the east, the disarmed enemy forces, mass starvation, the famine, and mass deportations that Soviet Russia did in Eastern Central Germany. So mass atrocities committed that need a quote-unquote justification. And the Holocaust, of course, is the perfect fig leaf for that. If you commit a crime like the Holocaust, you have it coming. And that's what you hear again and again, you know, when you bring up the bad things that happened to the Germans at war's end after the war. Well, you had it coming. That's the simple answer, you know. And you had it coming means you point to the Holocaust, or after you, what you've done to minorities, to the Gypsies, to the Jehovah's Witnesses, to homosexuals, to the Jews, to the Slavs, whatever, is all put into the same pot. You had it coming. And there's a good motivation. Nobody wants to change that narrative, because the Second World War makes quote-unquote sense only if you have that black and white portrayal of good and evil. All wars are seen in the First World War in particular, is nowadays seen as senseless. There was no justification. Everybody was in it, and there's no single party who is guilty of it. Everybody was stupid, and everybody did the wrong thing, and it was a bad idea, and there was a fratricidal war without any purpose. And we can come to the same conclusion with the Second World War, but realistically speaking, the thing that prevents us from seeing that this was a bad war too is the Holocaust, because the Holocaust makes it look like a good war of black against white, of good against evil. And it's so untrue, because if you just look at the very simple fact, when the war broke out, Germany and Russia, or Germany and the Soviet Union, I should say, divided up Poland. So there were two aggressor nations, but only one of them I've got a declaration of war from England and France, and the other one was let off the hook. And then the question is, when America decided to go to war too, by that time, you say, okay, you have two dictatorships, really dangerous, powerful dictatorships in Europe or in the Eurasian continent, I should say. You have the Soviet Union and you have Nazi Germany. And both of them were, morally speaking, bad. But how bad were they? By the time war broke out, you look at how many victims, according to the orthodox and mainstream narrative, Hitler had caused. And you're probably going to tell you some 1,000 people. You had the Röhm Putsch in 1934, where they killed themselves. So a few dozen SA people were killed. Then you had the November pogrom against the Jews in November 38, where roughly 100 people, I think, died, 100 Jews. And then you had, of course, already casualties in the few concentration camps that existed up to the war, like Buchenwald and Dachau and so a few others. That may have amounted to a few thousand, maybe. So we're talking about a few thousand people who had died as a consequence of oppression in Germany. But then you have the Soviet Union, and you look at how many people had died in the Soviet Union and were keep dying there on a regular basis by the time war broke out, whether you call it 39 or 41, doesn't make a big difference. And you say, well, Soviet Union by that time had caused, do we agree? Is it 10 million, 20 million, 30 million? I don't know. We're talking about tens of millions. So we're talking about a factor of 1,000 more victims, at least, in the Soviet Union than in the Third Reich. And the Third Reich's primary declaration was to build up a bulwark against the horrors of Bolshevism that had cost these tens of millions of Jews, and Germany was the only country that could block and prevent this horror from Russia to spreading all over the world. And that was a primary goal of National Socialism, make Germany strong and turn it into a bulwark against that Soviet menace. They didn't have any aggressive intention against the West or the North or whatever. It was primarily directly against the Soviet Union. They even had a pact with Poland to that effect for a while until that went sour in the late 30s. So if you go to war as a Western country, you look at the bad, two bad countries, that Germany trying to become strong with brutal measures against Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union, who had caused tens of millions of people to be slaughtered, butchered of their own people. Which is the bigger menace? And if those two countries invade Poland, who would should be your primary target to counter? I'm not saying necessarily to wage war against. How do we wage war against the Soviet Union? It's like the same problem now. How do we wage against war against Russia? You can't attack Russia because you can't invade it and occupy it. This just becomes, it's too big. It's never going to work. Has never worked. It's not worked for
Yeah,
Napoleon. It's not worked for
so
Hitler. It's not going to work for the Ukraine either. So
it's a
it's not going
cordon
anywhere.
sanitaire, you defensive alliance,
Right.
yeah.
So you need to make a decision there. And of course, after the Second World War was over, they all realized, well, I think it's put in Churchill's mouth, but I don't think it's accurate, said saying something to the effect, we slaughtered the wrong pig. They should have figured that one out earlier.
It's a
Should have
little
worked
late
with
for that,
democratic,
Winston.
you should have, yeah, you should have worked with democratic Germany between the wars, helping it, making it strong, so you had to have a real democratic bulwark against the chaos that is running in Soviet Russia, rather than waiting for a strong man, Hitler, who pulls Germany out of the trash can, out of the Civil War trash can, and then having to deal with that. So,
It
but
was
even that
Churchill that
was,
imposed the hunger blockade in the World War.
Hitler was still a choir boy compared to Stalin at that point, and you're making some bad choices by making Hitler the primary enemy. He could have been a friend. It sounds stupid, but it's actually true.
Well,
Now, I have to say,
in your encyclopedia, I'm sorry, you kind of allude to that there was a broader, at least long-term strategic planning in waging war on Germany, because Germany emerged in the eight after 1870 as a primary industrial power and started to take on the British Empire as an economic power, because it developed its economy, largely outside, the liberal free trade, sort of the custom union that it formed, and under Bismarck, he resolved the Cultural War, and Germany unified with a fantastically productive, a labor market, working, labor source, and it became a challenge to British economic and global economic primacy, which the British Empire saw as an eventual threat to its global, geopolitical primacy. And they never wanted Europe or the European continent, Eurasia, to develop, on its own. And so they kind of waged a 30 years war against a second 30 years war against Germany.
You have a similar, it's different, but if you look at Germany,
we see
Germany
it today, actually, we see it today.
Today we have a conflict between the United States and China. China is bound to, it depends a little bit, but it could overtake the United States economically. And it was a similar situation back then with Germany going through the roof economically and England being left behind in the dust. And England didn't want to give up on its empire. Now, I have an appointment coming up here, so I will have to cut it short. We have had already a long time, and I hope your listeners enjoyed it.
Okay, so I'll let you go. I'll provide the links to if the Holocaust Encyclopedia. Yes. Where's the best place to order it?
You can go either to holocaustencyclopedia.com, to nukebook.org, or to the armreg.co.uk website. Either will work, but Armreg has a little bit limited delivery countries to Europe and the Americas. So if you're anywhere outside of that region, you would have to go to the nukebook.org or encyclopedia.com.
Excellent.
Encyclopedia.com.
Well, Gamar, thank you for your time. Thank you for the wonderful talk.
Most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Good luck with everything. Take care.
Okay. You too.